Young People Panel. My name is Tone. I'm a person in recovery. Hello, everyone. So yeah, let me just tell real quick a bit about how this came to be. Well, among other things, like 6 months ago, I started a physical young people CODA meeting with two friends I met in recovery. I've heard from a lot of these young folks that they really appreciate to have like a place where they can share experience, strength, and hope with their peers and on any recovery-related topic, right? So it kind of feels like a secular thing, even though it's a more traditional one. It's a bit loose or more open to topics like mental health. And it's not all about alcohol and addiction, right? It's about what young folks go through in their recovery. And I've been hearing a lot of experience, strength, and hope from less young people. I thought it'd be awesome to have a young people panel, to have some young folks share on their recovery. Yeah, so we did. That's about all I have to share on why did we do this, because it's awesome. That's thanks to my lovely co-host and friend, Marcia, and Alex. We have found a few speakers who are going to share their experience, strength, and hope with us today. And because I'm the host, I get to pick who goes first. So how about we just get started here? Adam, would you like to go first?
Sure, I can start off.
Awesome.
Adam, alcoholic. Yeah, I was kind of like trying to think on what to share about today. I guess it's interesting when we talk about like a young people's panel, because last year, well, in the middle, at the beginning of the pandemic, myself and my friend Alex, we wound up starting a secular young people's meeting, and it was interesting to see the shift in dynamic when it was a meeting dedicated to young people, and it was like a group of us who were just able to share on our experiences and talk about things, and it kind of created a unique space for us to be able to talk about stuff. And I guess over time, I started learning more about kind of why the conversation felt more natural when I was around other young people. And I think a big aspect of it is really around when I talk to other young people, I find others have a lot more of a holistic view of recovery and have AA as a small facet of their recovery, as opposed to a central figure. Which I find really fascinating, because a lot of people, when I talk to them, and myself included, I think of recovery as a major part of my support network more than anything. My recovery and me showing up to meetings and me talking to people and having sponsees and stuff like that, it's really more than anything been about just kind of having that support network around me. But I also recognize that it's not the only thing that keeps me sober, and far from it. I've needed to take care of a lot of mental health stuff, and this year has been a fucking adventure unto itself, because I finally got a formal diagnosis on my mental health stuff and dealing with that whole roller coaster as well. But all of these things kind of have their impacts on my recovery as a whole, and I really appreciate how when I'm in young people's rooms and talking to like friends and stuff like that who are in recovery, I love the holistic aspect of being able to talk about mental health and being able to talk about how different facets of mental health affect my recovery, and being able to have that open and honest conversation, because without having that conversation, I feel like there's a piece of my recovery that's missing. I mean, I don't find this in secular rooms nearly as much as I do traditional, but like the outside issues thing. And I know that there's another panel that's going to be talking about this, later on this afternoon, but like talking about outside issues and how like a lot of people who I talk to on a regular basis have more of a stance of there really is no such thing as outside issues. All of these things affect our sobriety. All of these things have an impact on how I deal with my day-to-day and avoid addictive tendencies. so how is it ever an outside issue? And yeah, there are certain things that are like maybe more touchy subjects to touch on and stuff like that. But at the same time, if it's something that's going to affect my mental health in any way, shape, and form, I know that that's not an outside issue to me. That's something that I need to be able to talk about, and I need to have a space for. Otherwise, I'm suppressing a part of what I need to talk about to take care of my mental health and take care of my sobriety. So yeah, it just, it was something that kind of came to mind as I was like thinking about what to share about today, is kind of how I find that kind of interesting. Beyond that, I guess, just kind of looking at my journey a little bit and talking a bit about where I've kind of come from. 3.5 years sober, well, coming up on 3.5 years sober. And I kind of like started between both the traditional and secular rooms. I wound up kind of in a weird mix of both for a long time, where I was in a lot of the LGBT rooms in traditional AA, while also coming to a lot of the secular rooms in secular AA, which turned into a rather interesting mix because I had a traditional sponsor for the first like year and a half of sobriety. But the methodology never quite worked for me. The gaudiness of it just kind of stood out, and I didn't quite understand why I was doing what they wanted me to do. And over time, it's been kind of fascinating to me because I remember back when I first walked into the rooms, after my first meeting, I literally started writing down a logical approach to the 12 steps. And it was kind of hilarious because I was like sitting there writing down all these like interpretations that I just kind of felt about the traditional 12 steps and how they could like apply to somebody who is of a more secular nature. And I will never forget that list because it's still saved on my phone. And when I came over to the secular rooms, because I kind of came in to the secular rooms later, as I came into the secular rooms, I start hearing these different versions of the steps and I'm like, oh shit, so I'm not crazy. Like there are actually other interpretations of this and I'm not the only one to have thought about these things. Zoom forward about a year into my sobriety and Staying Sober Without God, Jeffrey Munn's book, got released. And I literally read through this book and I went, holy fuck, this is what I've been like guiding myself through the 12 steps with for the last like year and a half without having the words to it. And it just kind of shifted my whole perspective on like how I kind of worked my step work. And it's been really good. Like I found it was just a more straightforward approach to being able to work through my past and work through my trauma and work through the shit that I've kind of gone through in a more logical capacity. And in doing so, I also kind of learned a lot about the overlap between traditional and secular AA and kind of started being able to see a lot more of, how to put it, I could see what people in traditional AA were doing and how it aligned with what people in secular AA do too. For example, like when people talk about prayer and stuff like that, for me, when I'm looking at it from a psychological perspective, prayer is repetition. And by repeating certain things and focusing on certain things every single day, it becomes in the forefront of your thoughts. When it's in the forefront of your thoughts, you start changing behaviors and patterns and start changing the way that you react to things because it's something that's actively in your thought process. And I mean, similarly to what I've needed to do for my recovery is I've needed to focus on certain aspects of my recovery or certain behaviors or certain things for a specific amount of time and had to keep reminding myself of those things because that was how I changed those behaviors and shifted those behaviors to a more healthy way. So I've always found it really, really interesting. And just kind of the more I've dug into things, the more I can see the overlap between traditional and secular AA, even though that there's this ominous like divide between the two. When you look at what a lot of people are doing and how a lot of people work their programs, psychologically speaking, I don't find they're nearly as different as we sometimes talk about them. And I've kind of retained a lot of friends in both traditional and secular AA. And I like may not work my program the same way as them, but there's an understanding there and there's like a respect there because I have an understanding of how they manage what they manage and what they do. And I think that's really, really cool. I don't know what else to kind of talk about. I guess one thing that is, I know not a lot of people do in secular AA and has been something I've been kind of working on. And I know a few other young people have started getting into it is sponsorship. Cause I know it's a big, like, to do or not to do thing, especially within the young people group. I've had some really good success with sponsoring. And it's been kind of interesting. Definitely a lot more open in terms of like how we approach things and how I've done things. Cause obviously like in traditional AA sponsorship is a lot more show them how your sponsor taught you. And I've kind of struggled with this because my sponsor was a traditional sponsor and half of what she taught me wasn't quite working for me. And I was using stuff that I was learning in secular AA in order to substitute. So I guess it's been a lot of like showing people kind of how I work through things over time. But sponsorship's been a unique experience for me as well. And that's kind of been a new thing over the last year that I've been kind of working through and working with a few different guys from our group. I really don't know what else to ramble on. So I think I'm going to wrap up on that. But it was really nice chatting and sharing here. And I thank you guys for asking me to come out. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks, man. That was great.
Awesome, Adam. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. And that was great. So let's see. Next up, Zoe, do you want to introduce yourself and share?
Yeah, of course. I'm Zoe. I'm 18 years old and I'm an addict. I have been in recovery, I think, for 5 months. So that's not quite long. But I think today I just want to talk a little bit about my road to recovery. How did I get there? And what it took to like change my behavior and go in my recovery. So yeah. Before I went into recovery, I went to a clinic. It's called Yes We Can, and it's a clinic for quite young people. And they take you in for 10 weeks and they actually just break you down and build you back up again. And what happened there is that I got confronted with my own behavior very hard. So they told me my main problems were being very aggressive, having an alcohol problem. I'm very addicted to everything. Like I can get addicted to almost everything. I'm like very much a cross addiction person. And one of my main issues as well was being very codependent and having abandoning issues. And in my time in the clinic, they actually just started to confront me with my own behavior. And after I saw how many people I hurt, that's why step 8 is for me one of the most important steps in the whole plan, because I saw how many people I hurt with my addiction, my behavior, that I felt so much shame. I just wanted to do it different. So after I got out of rehab, I started to go to meetings, and that was when I really started to struggle with my recovery, because in the meetings, I didn't really find anything that supported my recovery for me until I kept going for a couple of times. And the thing that I struggled most with was my higher power, because I don't believe in God. I don't believe in anything, a person or somebody higher than me. So I found it hard to like fill that in for myself and go to meetings and hear about God. I just started to seek some interest in a couple things, and I came out with The Secret, The Law of Attraction. And that really worked for me. Not the whole thing that I believe that anything you want you can get, but more like if you think really positive, positive things will come your way and positive things will come to your path. And if you keep thinking negative and doing negative things, that also the negative things will come into your life and get attracted by you, because you're attracting what you think. So for that really helps me, because when I struggle with something, first I mostly of the time try to call other people that are in recovery to just empty my heart and try to get like a couple of suggestions of things I can do. And after that, I try to visualize what I want to do. So for example, if I have a fight at home, I will call with some of the people in recovery, and after that I will go to a meeting and I will try to look at it in a positive way, like, okay, it's going to be okay. I'm going to talk with my feelings about it afterwards. And I see that we're not going to fight anymore. And after some time you attract that as well. So that's for me, my higher power. I also struggled a lot in my recovery with Just for Today, because my brain is that addict that when I hear Just for Today, I say, okay, let's do it tomorrow. But after some time, if you keep telling yourself, okay, today I'm gonna have a good day, I'm gonna be clean, I'm gonna try to make the best out of my day. If you try to make every day your best day, I think that's really important in recovery, and just enjoy the little things. And I know that a lot of times people are gonna really wanna, for me, then fall back into old patterns or in like drinking. But for me, then step 8 comes in, because I managed to make like a picture in my head of my rock bottom moment when I was so fucked up and had so much to drink and fucked up everything around me. Like, I never want to go back to that place. And every time that I think, okay, I want to go back in old behavior, I think about that moment and know that I never want to go back. And that's why the steps are very important to me as well, because every time I go back, I will see how many people I hurted in my life. I think that's the main thing, to also like keep being in touch with people around you, with people that are also in recovery, because they will bring you up. If you only talk to people with bad behavior, I know for me, it was very hard to let all of my friends go, but people in recovery will help you to get up again, and you will support each other, and just have a good life with people that are also in recovery will help you to not fall back. I think that's the main things that help me keep being clean and be a little bit sweet for yourself and for everything that you do. I think that's very important for me. I always do a 6-minute journal after my day was done, and I write down where I'm grateful of, and I write down how my day went. And after seeing every day what was a troubling situation for me, what was good, I think I will get to see patterns and try to break them. So I think that's what helps me keep being clean. And yeah, I want to thank you so much for listening to me. Thank you.
Thanks, Zoe. That was awesome. And congrats on having 5 months of recovery. That's great. That's great. Let's see. We have one more speaker left. Lena, do you want to unmute and go ahead and share?
I'm the last one. Okay. I will try to talk for 40 minutes, but will probably fail. The last time that I was the only speaker at a meeting, I thought I had been talking like my entire life, and I looked up at the clock and it had been 10 minutes. So that was a short meeting. Anyway, hello, everybody. My name is Lena. I've stopped drinking and I want to keep it that way. I'm 28 years old. So, but I, you know, my recovery journey started a long time ago. You know, I mean, I probably drank a few times as a teenager, but it wasn't like really a problem until I was about 18 and I was introduced to drugs. Like, for me, drugs and alcohol, they're just so intertwined that I can't talk about one without the other. The first time that I did drugs, I remember just like crying, because like crying with joy, sort of, because I knew that my life was never going to be the same. I just didn't have the ability to predict in what ways it wouldn't be the same. I was absolutely right about that feeling, because, you know, ultimately I would end up spending my future years in the shadow, basically, of how good that felt for me. And once I kind of started, it's sort of like my brain was hijacked with the knowledge that I had the ability to control, quote unquote, my emotions, my brain, and my whole experience of life. And after that, it was all downhill from there. It emerged over time, but pretty much what ended up happening is I was drinking alcohol every day, sort of to get through the week. And then in a twisted way at the time, I saw it as my spirituality, like my spiritual focus was to get to the weekend or whatever event so that I could use drugs. And it was just this endless, endless cycle. In the spaces that, like, I was a part of a lot of communities, I guess, where substance abuse is normalized. Like, you know, I had a lot of like raver friends and stuff like that. So, you know, it all kind of struck me as very normal. And the media that I consumed, like at the time, I was really into The Weeknd, who used to sing a lot of darker music, pretty much all just about this lifestyle of just abusing substances all the time. And I thought there was something very glamorous about it. I remember, like, I used to think that my thing, my thing was that I would get alcohol and drink it in public bathrooms. And I just thought it was so cool that I like drank in every public bathroom by myself. But I really did feel cool. Like, that's the damn truth. And it took me a long time before I ever saw how ridiculous that was. I was so burnt out, you know, waking up in the middle of the night every night, just dying of thirst, or, you know, never getting a proper night's sleep and just being hungover all the time. And the thing is, like, being in that cycle, like, I'm sure that potentially everybody here can relate, or at least a lot of people, it's being in that cycle where like your sobriety is so much worse because you're hungover, that it just makes the picture of alcohol just like so much better. And it became so normal for me that I really did not know or believe that there was a different kind of sobriety. It doesn't help that when I was a kid, I was really, really depressed. So I basically went from depression to substance abuse. And so, like, you know, with these ideas of like being restored to sanity or whatever, like, I didn't want to go back to the way that I was. I didn't remember a time that I was happy. So I didn't even really know that there was something I was supposed to be reaching for. Over time, you know, things started piling up. I started to have like really upsetting experiences. I was in a lot of dangerous situations. I experienced my share of like assault and things like that. It was just all compounded by the fact that I was out of my mind and I was unable to say no. And also just the fact that I was so out of touch with myself. Obviously, I wasn't doing personal development. I was too busy drinking. There was a time when like a very close family member had an overdose. He's alive, he's okay, but it was definitely like a life-threatening experience. And then, you know, I'm listening to my mom cry on the phone, and like, and then I was out there doing drugs again that weekend. Like, and that's when I really got it in my head, like, this is kind of sick. And for me, you know, like, I don't really believe in bottoms personally. Like, you know, you can always keep digging, as some people like to say. But if I had to pinpoint one, it would probably be this day where my friend totally, like, I introduced my friend to drugs and she overdosed while I was there. And I was just so out of it that I was just kind of like, this is fine. And I didn't call an ambulance. Thankfully, she lived. Oh my gosh. Like, I think of that just with terror every night. But I think the reason why that was such a game changer for me is that I couldn't continue to tell myself that my drinking was only affecting me. Because obviously, if it was completely obliterating my capacity to respond to a literal life-threatening situation that I started, it was my idea, you know, clearly it was putting those that I love in harm's way. So I didn't immediately get sober after that, but, you know, it festered. And then I was kind of thinking about maybe I should get some help, but I wasn't interested in an AA at all until somebody in my life said, hey, you know, there's secular AA. And I was like, what's secular AA? And then one thing led to another. Like, I'm in Toronto, so there were meetings here. This is all pre-COVID. This is like 7 years ago. So, yeah, so I went to my first meeting. I was accompanied by the person who overdosed, actually. She attended as my support, and that meant the world. I don't know how easy it would have been to show up without her, but, you know, there's just something about, I mean, I cried my eyes out, didn't so many of us, like, just the energy of just being around sober people and just seeing the example of a possible other way to live. And for me, it's just everybody in my life normalized drinking, and the fact that there was all these people who were here to model something better for me was just a game changer. So I started going to those meetings, but it didn't immediately stick. You know, I had relapses. I had a couple. And I wasn't aware of my triggers at the time, and I was getting myself into situations that were super triggering. Like, for me, one of my triggers is feeling out of control. So I had a friend visit from the United States in my literally one room. Like, I rented a room in an apartment, and I had nowhere to go, and I was so stressed out. And she was there for like 2 weeks, and I ended up drinking. And, you know, now I know better. Now I don't put myself in those sorts of situations, but it was all a learning process. Ultimately, I got it in my head that, like, you know what they say about the geographical change or whatever it's called, like, wherever you go, there you are. You know, I think there's an element of truth to that. But at the same time, I realized I was not going to be able to get sober in Toronto. I was surrounded by everything that triggered me and away from pretty much all of my supports, like, namely my mom. So I ended up heading up north, and I should say too, like, this is privilege, right? Not everybody can go stay with their mom and stop working so that they can get help. But I'm very thankful that I did have that opportunity, and I took that opportunity, and I wish everybody had similar opportunities. But yeah, I ended up going to rehab. It was a live-in treatment center for 3 weeks. I should say that I ramped up my drinking before I went, and it was very frightening. But my last drink, I have to say, my last drink did not feel like my last drink. I had so much hesitation, so much reservation. And over time, I kind of felt like I was getting messaging in AA that if, like, it didn't feel like your last drink, it might not be your last drink. Maybe you didn't really hit bottom. But for me personally, I recommend maybe not listening to that, because I don't really see how it's helpful. And for me, it wasn't true. For me, sobriety ended up being about just one day at a time, just the daily choice to keep chugging along, even when I wasn't sure of myself, because I was almost never, never sure of myself. There were some moments where it's like, you know, the light would shine through the clouds and, you know, kind of like holy moments. But for the most part, it was just really scary. and yeah, rehab, I mean, rehab, AA, pretty much all the help and support and treatment that I've received, like, none of it was perfect. I have criticisms about all of it. But absolutely, it was just this process of, like, being in these environments where, like, if my sobriety is like this crystal and just turning it around and seeing the light go through it all these different ways. And even for the ideas that didn't end up working for me, just the exercise of thinking about sobriety, thinking about all these ways I could recover, it was an opportunity to learn about myself and just learn. I had to visualize a different life, you know, for me, the idea of the spiritual experience, I think, is just this idea that we have an entire self that's rooted in alcohol. We need a new self, almost. You know, I'm not saying you have to lose all the aspects of your own self, but for me, once I took away alcohol, there was almost nothing left. So I learned how to relive. And the first year or two was incredibly challenging. And I had a lot of unconventional coping strategies. I can't say that I recommend this, but one thing that I would do is when it was really bad and I was basically like, I am going to drink, I would say, okay, here's what I'll do. I'm going to wait 2 days. And if I experience one really good, if I experience one moment in this time period where I feel good or not like drinking or whatever, then the clock will like reset for another 2 days, because those moments were worth my sobriety. And when I was like really in it, I couldn't even imagine that those moments would come again. And inevitably, within those 2 days, I would have a good feeling. And then, yeah, I'd like reset the clock. I mean, that can be risky. I know that not everybody, like my mental health is like decent. I know that not everybody experiences good things every couple of days, but I don't know. That's just what worked for me, you know, and I did have a sponsor. I did work the steps in my own way. One thing I wish I could go back and tell my younger self is just like, hey, you know, you don't stop obsessing over if you're doing it right and if you're doing it thoroughly enough. You know, it was such a waste of my energy. Just like, oh no, this one interpretation of the steps isn't endorsed by official AA. If I'm following it, have I really done this step or am I doomed to drink? I think it had to do with, for me personally, I don't operate well with some of the traditional messaging that I know does work for some people. So I'm not trying to knock it, but I mean like this whole idea of, yeah, like you know, you have a bottom and go to meetings or you'll die. And, you know, you have to fully give yourself over in your step two or whatever. For me, those things were all traps because I tend to look at things with nuance, or if I don't, I will eventually find plot holes. If I turned my life over to any one thing, I would always be able to find something wrong with that thing and it would shake my foundation. Whereas if my foundation is just like, I'm doing the best I can today with what I got, you know, that was a lot more healthy of an approach for me. And yeah, literally, you know, there was sometimes where I would get so triggered, I could like feel it. I remember this one time I was like on the bed, just like shaking because I was so overwhelmed because I could feel what it was like if I went back out again. Like, you know, the brain remembered what it was like to be drunk and high. And in those moments, I was like, just 10 more seconds, just like one more minute, just, you know, I just have to focus on the next minute. And eventually it would pass. And, you know, it's one thing to stay sober when it's easy, but those moments were the greatest triumphs of my sobriety because each time I made it through one of these terrible cravings, my brain rewired itself. My brain at the time did not even understand that I could have a craving and it didn't have to lead to the action of drinking, right? I remember I had this, like, artistic visualization or something where it was like there was this demon that would take over my body and then I became the demon, and that was to me what my alcoholism was. But yeah, in my sobriety I learned there's a space between, you know, your craving and your action, and you can stay in that space. It's uncomfortable. The more times that I survive that, the more it's like in my bones, like in my cells, I could feel that space like expanding, the knowledge, the belief that I did not have to respond to my cravings. That happened after a year or two. And I don't know if this is partially because I'm a young person, because I was a young person when I sobered up, but I do feel like my brain rewired itself to the point where, and I feel like this is, you know, not a popular thing to say in AA, but honestly, today my sobriety is very, very easy. I've been sober over 5 years. It's honestly kind of a thank you. It's sort of a non-issue for me. I do try and stay mindful. You know, I go to some meetings and whenever I get those calls from like somebody who's struggling, I actually find it really helps me because I can pretty easily forget that I'm an alcoholic most days. And I'm glad to have that in my back pocket, that memory, just every once in a while, remember, because I don't want to be caught off guard. But yeah, the cravings, I almost never even get cravings. And when I do, it just feels like a memory of a person I used to be. Before I forget too, I know I just said I was an alcoholic, but I should say that in talking about sort of like blanket statements that don't work for me, I actually do not find the concept of alcoholic helpful, especially as a young person, relevant. People very frequently, when I moved up north and I was going to traditional meetings, and it was like an older crowd for sure. in a more conservative area, I guess, like not conservative, but just traditional. Yeah, people were always basically judging me as not being alcoholic enough. And it absolutely tied into me being an atheist as well, because it went against their worldview, I would say, for a lot of people, that an atheist was getting sober, an atheist alcoholic was getting sober without God. And so a lot of people would say this whole thing about real alcoholics, how real alcoholics need God to get sober. And other people are just, I don't know, problem drinkers or whatever. I mean, and I cannot begin to tell you how much mental energy I wasted being like, am I an alcoholic? Your friends who drink, and then they're like, well, you know, don't you just like want to have one beer someday? And like, just this, I would go around and around and around, and it's like a total waste of time. I think the science is largely unclear on exactly what alcoholism is. I have no doubt that we need to have sympathy for the way it just gets its fangs in people. And obviously some people are affected by it more than others. And as for the question of if I can ever drink again, I think that considering my life experience, if I ever decide to risk going back to that life because I want to have a beer, that's alcoholic thinking, right? I think anybody who had a good relationship with alcohol would have enough evidence based on my life to say, you know what, I'll pass. And so that's definitely what keeps me sober today. I will never risk that again. For me, it's just the freedom of not having to think about alcohol. You know how I said that these years of my life were lived in the shadow of my first experience being high? Like, that's what I'm free from today. I do not walk around the world comparing my good experiences to my first high. I just don't. It's irrelevant. It feels like a different person, and it feels just insignificant compared to the depth and richness of all the experiences I have today that are about so much more than just getting as high as possible. And that is such a gift. It's such a gift. It was so much more than just not drinking, not using. It was my freedom. So that's pretty much the story of my recovery, but I guess I'll also talk a little bit, because I still have lots of time, don't I? Oh, I'm not doing bad. Let's go. I'll talk a little bit about my experience in service. When I moved to North Bay, as I said, very traditional area, there was no secular meetings. And that was very, very challenging. I missed my Toronto people so much. Like right now I'm living in Toronto and it's so nice just to be around some of the meetings here. It just makes me so happy. But yeah, in North Bay I didn't have that. And so besides the fact that they weren't secular, the people there, it's just the way that community had kind of shaped up, is that there was just a lot of dogmatic traditional thinking and not a lot of exposure to other ideas. And I felt like every meeting I went to was an adversary. Not every, no. I would say half the meetings I went to were adversarial experiences. And I'm not saying to anybody that they shouldn't go. Obviously, different communities have different people. Different people respond differently to different communities. And different people respond differently to adversity. I did not tolerate adversity very well. I was still welcomed. I just struggled with our differences. And, you know, I guess that's on me. But also, I think it's fair. You're not going to fit in every place. I don't beat myself up like, oh, why didn't you just enjoy the meeting or whatever? But also, again, just going in, thinking about sobriety a bunch of different ways, even if it pissed me off, that particular meeting, it still helped. And there was still absolutely people who were there for me, people who would pick up my calls if I needed anything, people who would give me a hug if I wanted one. Like, and that's invaluable, right? But after a year or two, I thought, this city needs a good dose of secular AA. So I decided to start the meeting there. And I'd love to say that it's North Bay's first secular AA meeting. Wow. Yeah, I know. I'm so cool. Very humble. I'm a humble person. And thankfully I had the support from some of the people in Toronto, but it ended up being kind of a lot easier than I thought, really. When it came down to it, what did I need? I needed a meeting format, which I was able to get from some friends in Toronto. I needed a location. That was kind of interesting. I didn't really want to have it in a church, personally, but we ended up having a sort of partnership with an art gallery, and they let us rent their space effectively for free. Like, I gave them $50 every 3 months, but it was effectively free. You know, I just tried to get the word out, these different places I went. And I mean, I could have easily overcomplicated it in my head, and I'm sure that I did at times, but ultimately, you know, it's just people getting together and talking recovery. And I was so excited, and, you know, we got a little core group going, but it ended up being a pretty interesting saga in the end, because there was a lot of resistance, and that resistance started to show up at the district level. People, I think their first problem, because there was a host of problems, but I think the first one was that we read a different version of the steps. So we would have, you know, our district meetings, and they would kind of be like, are they allowed to read alternate versions of the steps? You know, we're like pulling out like things Bill W. said, and we're like pulling out the traditions, and, you know, it was a whole thing. And I really just was so shocked that it was such a problem. But looking back, like at the time I thought I was angry, but looking back, it lit my fire. Like, I was so enthusiastic about, I guess, you know, winning this fight. It's probably not a good way to look at it, but it felt like a fight. And I was so enthusiastic about just like making North Bay a safer space for us, you know, agnostics, atheists, free thinkers. And it was awesome, actually. It was hard. It was challenging. There was a lot of things that were emotionally difficult. But, you know, I had done other types of service, but I guess I'm just saying, in doing service, you never know what you're going to tap into that will enrich you and enrich your recovery. So I'm really glad that I tried all sorts of different things. Yes, we had that conflict about the steps, and we had a conflict about, we wanted to have a note saying we were secular on the area website, and they didn't want to give it to us. And they were like, can't people just tell from your name, we agnostics? And but then they were literally saying that we couldn't be an AA group without God or something. I honestly don't remember. It's quite some time ago. But in any case, in the end, the most amazing thing happened. You know, I still move to think of it. These people at the district level ended up hearing us out. They heard my impassioned speech, you know. They came and met with our group and talked to people in the group. And then they also read up on things that Bill W. said and whatever. And they apologized. So they apologized at a district meeting. They said we were wrong. Like, oh, I'm actually emotional just thinking about it. And they, you know, they said, like, you know, we want you to continue to help people, you know, who are benefited by this. And, you know, it's all recovery sort of thing. And it was such a life-affirming moment for me. One problem that I've had throughout my life is the tendency to other people, you know, make enemies out of humans. And I had seen them as my enemies for some time. And just that show of empathy and humility and care was so overwhelming and beautiful. And it reminded me that I really cannot be carrying all that hatred and othering into all my experiences with anybody, but especially not traditional AA. You know, after some time, I formed a better and better relationship with these people. And I actually am just finishing a term as the alt DCM for our district. The DCM is somebody who's a little more traditional, but, you know, she and I, you know, we're like that. Like she taught me everything. She provided me so much support. And whenever there was something that went wrong with our secular meeting, like she was there for us. She was there to speak out for us. I'm so thankful for the whole experience. So in service, I'm just saying, yeah, you never know what's going to inspire you. Try lots of things if you're into that or don't. And there's all kinds of different things you can do. And you never know what lessons you'll learn and what friends you'll make. These days, after I'm done my term as alt DCM, I'm probably not going to be doing a lot of AA. Again, I know that's not something that's very accepted to say, but for me, as I said, I do feel like my brain sort of rewired itself. I am still working on self-improvement, so I haven't stopped growing, but for me, I'm just more interested in other areas right now. If this, I mean, who knows? Maybe with time, I'll realize that that was an unwise choice. I'm not saying that I have all the answers, but I will say that for me right now, that feels right. And I don't think that people should doom themselves to drinking if they start feeling like meetings aren't working for them. I don't think shoot yourself in the foot. But that being said, if there's ever a little voice in my head that says, maybe I need a meeting, I go. It's always better for me to just go and just give it a try. See if I'll learn something that day. If you don't, take what you want, leave the rest. Anyway, I'm really tired of hearing my own voice, but I think I did pretty good. So thank you so much for listening, and thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lena. That was awesome. I could have listened to that for hours and hours. Yeah, that concludes your sharing. Great stories we heard today from young people. That's what I love about the young people meetings. I still get to call myself a young person, right? So yeah, if anyone wants to raise a hand and give some feedback or ask something, go right ahead.
I'll start. My name is Mikey. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you all for the amazing shares. It was wonderful. When I heard there was a young people's group, I'm 51, so I don't know if that's young or not. It depends. It all of a sudden it's getting younger and younger as I get closer and closer. One thing I don't do is treat young people's meetings any different than any other meeting, and I don't treat young people any different than any other alcoholic. And that is because when I went to my first AA meeting, my first several AA meetings, it was back in 1986. And I was 16, I was on a psych ward, and I had to go to these AA meetings, and people would say things like, I spilled more liquor than you ever drank. And, you know, oh, you saved yourself so much pain. You know, you didn't have to go through the hell that I went through. And I'm like, I'm in a psych ward for the second time. What more pain do I need? I felt like I didn't qualify. And it drove me out. I felt like I needed some more experience, and that could have killed me. So I think it's a level playing field. And I definitely understand the service thing with starting up meetings. It is sometimes very difficult to get like-minded people together and have unlike-minded people accept us. But when it all comes down to it, my go-to phrase when they would say, well, you can't do this or can't do that, I would say, well, how is that helpful to an alcoholic? How is that decision helpful to someone that wants to get sober? And it you know, most of them are worked out. But thank you all for the great shares. It was awesome. So it looks like Bobby is next.
Hey, everyone. Bobby's my name. I didn't drink today and I desire to drink today. Yeah, it was good to come to this meeting. It's great to see Adam. It's been very much a long time since I've seen you. And I'm so happy to hear you're doing so well. I can relate to a lot of stuff what people are saying. You know, that whole concept of alcoholic, you know, I think it's an outdated term and it needs to change. Personally, I do not see the benefit of it because, as mentioned, for me, it gets into this kind of categorization of what is an alcoholic and what isn't, and everybody's subjective experience of that can have an influence on how I think about myself and where I belong more so. Now, that's a double thing. It's partly to do with people's ideas, but it's also my temperament and timidness as well. So in regards to expressing myself. So, you know, I have to be careful about how much blame I'm putting on to other people, and they could be trying to express themselves in a way and me too. And just recognizing that for me has been very important, but I still stand by it, you know, let's get rid of it, right? You know, when Adam's talking about, you know, outside issues and all that, and I've noticed that amongst the old guard in traditional AA and the young guard in traditional AA. I'm part of a men's group in Ireland, and it's a traditional one. And even though they're traditional, there's no outside issues, you know, and therefore, you know, when people bring in outside issues in traditional type meetings, you know, they tend to convert outside issues into alcoholic personality, alcohol thinking, and it kind of misdiagnose or prescribes people's problems. And, you know, when I was in AA initially, I found that very, very confusing and very harmful because, you know, I thought in order to help my certain problems in my life, that was my alcoholic personality, and therefore needed to attend meetings, you know. And that was the kind of the spirit I was given. But now with these young guys, they're not very open to the whole. They're still very program based and big book based, and that's the only text and all that. But at least they do consider and talk about outside issues, quote unquote, outside issues, sex, drugs, women, you know, all that kind of stuff, and sometimes men for the other guys. And it's just, it's great to have it, and I'd love to see more of it, particularly where I am. So, I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Mikey and everyone else doing service. That's awesome. And thanks, everyone, for visiting. Maybe we'll have a young people panel next year. We'll see.
It was great.